A one-man revolution. A guerrilla scholar warrior. A renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast. This is Prof. CJ. And today I'm going to be talking about some things from the Peloponnesian War, which lasted from 431 to 404 BC. And the Peloponnesian War, if you don't know, was a long drawn out conflict between the Athenians and their empire and allies of the various Greek city-states of the ancient world, and the Spartans and their allies and subjects in their areas of Greece that they controlled. Greece in ancient times was fragmented politically into hundreds of small to mid-sized city-states, some of which were more powerful than others, and there was a high degree of diversity in terms of how they were ruled and so on. The Peloponnesian War is really interesting because you have, on the one hand, the arguably most democratic of the Greek city-states, the Athenians, who were also the most commercial and the most, you know, culturally significant, going against, in many ways, their opposite number, the Spartans, or as they were called back then, the Lacedaemonians. And this war we know a lot about in part because of the detailed chronicling of it by the Athenian general and historian Thucydides, who wrote the famous History of the Peloponnesian War. And what I'm going to be doing in this episode is not so much looking at a detailed history of the war, although I may do that in the future at some point, but I'm going to be looking at two famous passages in particular and looking at what they tell us about ancient Athens during this war, what they tell us about how war has a decivilizing effect that causes even societies that hold what we might consider humane values to lose those values, to have those degrade over time, to have that war has a corrosive effect on even relatively, by the standards of their contemporaries, humane societies, and how war changes a people. And then also, by implication, are there any lessons from the Peloponnesian War for today, for modern-day America and other present-day societies, as far as what war does to a people and how it warps a people? So we're going to be looking at these two famous passages. One of them is Pericles' funeral oration, and the other is what's known as the Melian Dialogue. So just briefly, Thucydides did not have verbatim transcripts of a lot of these speeches and dialogues and so on. So what he did is basically combine, in some cases, secondhand accounts of what was said with just sort of his best intuition as an experienced statesman in general of the type of things that were probably said. I mean, he was familiar enough with, you know, the Athenian and Spartan leaders to probably have a reasonable idea of the types of things they would have likely said and how they would have likely said it. So first we have Pericles, the great Athenian orator and statesman and leader of Athens in the early part of the Peloponnesian War, giving a funeral oration. This is only about a year into the war, and this speech is celebrating the dead Athenians who have died so far in the conflict. This is an Athenian custom that when they're at war, they'll have an orator give a funeral speech. So listen to this, and interesting thought experiment. While you're hearing this, maybe just ponder if you could imagine, say, a modern-day American politician saying similar sorts of things, obviously adapted to different times and circumstances. So Pericles' funeral oration. "Most of those who have spoken here before me have commended the lawgiver who added this oration to our other funeral customs. It seemed to them a worthy thing that such an honor should be given at their burial to the dead who have fallen on the field of battle. But I should have preferred that, when men's deeds have been brave, they should be honored in deed only, and with such an honor as this public funeral which you are now witnessing. Then the reputation of many would not have been imperiled on the eloquence or want of eloquence of one, and their virtues believed or not as he spoke well or ill. for it is difficult to say neither too little nor too much, and even moderation is apt to give the impression of truthfulness. However, since our ancestors have set the seal of their approval upon this practice, I must obey, and to the utmost of my power shall endeavor to satisfy the wishes and beliefs of all who hear me. I will speak first of our ancestors, for it is right and seemly that now, when we are lamenting the dead, a tribute should be paid to their memory. There has never been a time when they did not inhabit this land, which by their valor they will have handed down from generation to generation, and we have received from them a free state. But if they were worthy of praise, still more were our fathers, who added to their inheritance, and after many a struggle transmitted to us their sons this great empire. And we ourselves, assembled here today, who are still most of us in the vigor of life, have carried the work of improvement further, and have richly endowed our city with all things, so that she is sufficient for herself both in peace and war. Of the military exploits by which our various possessions were acquired, or of the energy with which we or our fathers drove back the tide of war, Hellenic or barbarian, I will not speak, for the tale would be long and is familiar to you. But before I praise the dead, I should like to point out by what principles of action we rose to power, and under what institutions and through what manner of life our empire became great. Our form of government does not enter into rivalry with the institutions of others. Our government does not copy our neighbors, but is an example to them. It is true that we are called a democracy, for the administration is in the hands of the many and not of the few. But while there exists equal justice to all and alike in their private disputes, the claim of excellence is also recognized, and when a citizen is in any way distinguished, he is preferred to the public service, not as a matter of privilege, but as a reward of merit. Neither is poverty an obstacle, but a man may benefit his country, whatever the obscurity of his condition. And we have not forgotten to provide for our weary spirits many relaxations from toil. We have regular games and sacrifices throughout the year. Our homes are beautiful and elegant, and the delight which we daily feel in all these things helps to banish sorrow. Because of the greatness of our city, the fruits of the whole earth flow in upon us, so that we enjoy the goods of other countries as freely as our own. Then again, our military training is in many respects superior to that of our adversaries, and in the matter of education, whereas they, talking about the Spartans, from early youth are always undergoing laborious exercises which are to make them brave, we live at ease, and yet are equally ready to face the perils which they face. If then we prefer to meet danger with a light heart, but without laborious training, and with a courage which is gained by habit and not enforced by law, are we not greatly the better for it? For we are lovers of the beautiful in our tastes, and our strength lies, in our opinion, not in deliberation and discussion, but that knowledge which is gained by discussion preparatory to action. In doing good, again, we are unlike others. We make our friends by conferring, not by receiving favors. We alone do good to our neighbors, not upon a calculation of interest, but in the confidence of freedom and in a frank and fearless spirit. To sum up, I say that Athens is the school of Hellas. By the way, that's an old school term for Greece, Hellas, continuing with Pericles. And that the individual Athenian, in his own person, seems to have the power of adapting himself to the most varied forms of action with the utmost versatility and grace. This is no passing and idle word, but truth and fact. And the assertion is verified by the position to which these qualities have raised the state. I have dwelt upon the greatness of Athens because I want to show you that we are contending for a higher prize than those who enjoy none of these privileges. For in magnifying the city, I have magnified them, and men like them, whose virtues made her glorious. And of how few Hellens can it be said as of them that their deeds, when weighed in the balance, have been found equal to their fame. I believe that a death such as theirs has been the true measure of a man's worth. Such was the end of these men. They were worthy of Athens. I would have you day by day fix your eyes upon the greatness of Athens until you become filled with the love of her. And when you are impressed by the spectacle of her glory, reflect that this empire has been acquired by men who knew their duty and had the courage to do it, who, in the hour of conflict, had the fear of dishonor always present to them, and who, if ever they failed in an enterprise, would not allow their virtues to be lost to their country, but freely gave their lives to her as the fairest offering which they could present at her feast. To you who are the sons and brothers of the departed, I see that the struggle to emulate them will be an arduous one. And if I am to speak of womanly virtues to those of you who will henceforth be widows, let me sum them up in one short admonition. To a woman not to show more weakness than is natural to her sex is a great glory, and not to be talked about for good or for evil among men. I have paid the required tribute in obedience to the law, making use of such fitting words as I had. The tribute of deeds has been paid in part, for the brave have them in deeds, and it remains only that their children should be maintained at the public charge until they are grown up. This is the solid prize with which, as with a garland, Athens crowns her sons living and dead after a struggle like theirs. For where the rewards of virtue are greatest, there the noblest citizens are enlisted in the service of the state. And now, when you have duly lamented everyone his own dead, you may depart. Now, I can just imagine in my own mind that after Pericles finished those thoughts, people started waving giant foam fingers and chanting, "Athens! Athens! Athens!" And that probably a band struck up and started playing their theme song, which, as far as I recollect, was entitled "Athens, Fuck Yeah." So all these virtues, all these wonderful things, Athens has an empire, yes, but it has an empire because it's so virtuous, you see. Unlike some of their neighbors and their rivals, Athens alone achieved power and glory through virtue rather than through ruthlessness and cruelty, right? Or at least that's what they tell themselves. Now, it doesn't take a whole lot of research or critical thought to know that a lot of what Pericles is saying is total patting yourself on the back rhetorically type stuff. It's no different than when Americans chant USA, USA and claim that they're the best at everything just because they're Americans and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's so many holes in Pericles' idealistic version of Athens that it's ridiculous. Nonetheless, it is an accurate depiction of what the Athenians at least thought in their own minds were the things that made them different and better than their rivals. So within, I think, about a year of giving that funeral oration, Athens was struck by a plague, and one of the casualties was Pericles himself. And the war was yet another of these wars that everybody thought would be over in a relatively short time that dragged on year after year after year. And as always happens with a very long, drawn-out war, the longer it drags on, the more of a corrosive, decivilizing effect it has on the participants. Now, in the case of the Spartans, they were already brutal, militaristic, authoritarian, totalitarian type of a society, right? So it's not as dramatic the effect that the war has on them, because they were already kind of on a war footing permanently, even during times of alleged peace. But in the case of the Athenians, this prolonged war that drags on for many years has a much more obvious change on how they speak, how they act, and they start throwing aside even the pretenses of sticking to these great virtues that they believe that they uniquely embody. So a situation develops about 15 years later into the war after that funeral oration, and it has to do with Athens confronting the people of a small island in the Mediterranean called Milos, which had been originally founded as a colony of Sparta, but which had been politically independent and which adopted a policy of staunch neutrality during this war between Athens and Sparta. And the Melians, all they wanted to do was just be left alone. They didn't want to take a side. They didn't want to mess with anybody. And they just wanted to, you know, be a little Switzerland there in the middle of the Peloponnesian War. But Athens wasn't going to let them get away with that. Athens basically had the view by this kind of middle point of the war, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. Oh, sorry, if you're not with us, you're with the Spartans. Excuse me. So Athens decides that basically neutrality on the part of Milos is unacceptable to them. Milos needs to join the Athenian alliance or Milos is going to suffer destruction. So this is what Thucydides, how he depicts this interaction between Athens and Sparta in what becomes known as the Melian Dialogue. And again, this is not word for word what actually happened. Thucydides is just doing his best to kind of reconstruct it. So this is like 16 years into the war. The Athenians made an expedition against the Isle of Milos. The Melians are a colony of Sparta that would not submit to the Athenians like the other islanders, and at first remained neutral and took no part in the struggle. But afterwards, upon the Athenians using violence and plundering their territory, assumed an attitude of open hostility. The Athenian generals encamped in their territory with the above armament, before doing any harm to their land, sent envoys to negotiate. These the Melians did not bring before the people, but bade them state the object of their mission to the magistrates and the few, upon which the Athenian envoy spoke as follows. So this is the dialogue as depicted by Thucydides. Athenians, since the negotiations are not to go on before the people, in order that we may not be able to speak straight on without interruption, and deceive the ears of the multitude by seductive arguments which would pass without refutation, for we know that this is the meaning of our being brought before the few. What if you who sit there were to pursue a method more cautious still? Make no set speech yourselves, but take us up at whatever you do not like, and settle that before going any further. And first, tell us if this proposition of ours suits you. So the Athenian envoys are saying basically, look, let's not do big, long speeches, let's have almost more like a debate where you can kind of stop us at any point to question something we're saying. So Thucydides continues. The Melian commissioners answered, Melians, to the fairness of quietly instructing each other as you propose, there is nothing to object. But your military preparations are too far advanced to agree with what you say, as we see you are come to be judges in your own cause, and that all we can reasonably expect from this negotiation is war, if we prove to have right on our side and refuse to submit, and in the contrary case, slavery. So the Melians are basically saying, look, you're standing there metaphorically with a knife to our throat, and what can we really expect from debating with you anyway? So, Athenians, if you have met to reason about presentiments of the future, or for anything else than to consult for the safety of your state upon the facts that you see before you, we will give over, otherwise we will go on. Melians, it is natural and excusable for men in our position to turn more ways than one, both in thought and utterance. However, the question in this conference is, as you say, the safety of our country, and the discussion, if you please, can proceed in the way which you propose. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, now that they've done sort of the preliminary wrangling. Athenians, for ourselves, we shall not trouble you with specious pretenses and make a long speech which would not be believed. And in return, we hope that you, instead of thinking to influence us by saying that you did not join the Spartans or that you have done us no wrong, will aim at what is feasible, holding in view the real sentiments of us both. Since you know as well as we do that right, as the world goes, is only in question between equals in power. While the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. Now that's one of the most famous lines in this whole thing. The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. The Athenians, after 15 years of war, are setting aside the bullshit and saying, look, we're a lot more powerful than you, so any argument based on what is right, what is just, is irrelevant because we're strong, you're not. End of story. Might makes right. Might is right. Contrast that to the idealistic sounding things stated by Pericles near the start of the war. Melians. As we think, at any rate, it is expedient. We speak as we are obliged, since you enjoin us to let right alone and talk only of interest, that you should not destroy what is our common protection, the privilege of being allowed in danger to invoke what is fair and right, and even to profit by arguments not strictly valid if they can be got to pass current. And you are as much interested in this as any, as your fall would be a signal for the heaviest vengeance and an example for the world to meditate upon. Athenians, the end of our empire, if end it should, does not frighten us. A rival empire like Sparta, even if Sparta was our real antagonist, is not so terrible to the vanquished as subjects who by themselves attack and overpower their rulers. This, however, is a risk that we are content to take. We will now proceed to show you that we are come here in the interest of our empire, and that we shall say what we are now going to say, for the preservation of your country, as we would fain exercise that empire over you without trouble, and see you preserved for the good of us both. So the Athenians are saying, listen, we'd rather you kind of submit to our authority quietly and without a struggle, because, you know, it would be more profitable for all of us if you just peacefully surrendered to our power and we don't have to destroy you. And so the Melians respond, and how, pray, could it turn out as good for us to serve as for you to rule? Athenians, because you would have the advantage of submitting before suffering the worst, and we should gain by not destroying you. Melians, so that you would not consent to our being neutral, friends instead of enemies, but allies of neither side. Athenians, no. For your hostility cannot so much hurt us as your friendship will be an argument to our subjects of our weakness and your enmity of our power. So here, to me, it sounds like the Athenians are concerned with the precedent it sets. Look, if this little island of Melos is able to successfully stay neutral and stay from being taken over by the Athenian Empire, that sets a precedent that other small cities in Greece might also want to just stay the hell out of Athens' beef with Sparta. Melians, is that your subject's idea of equity? To put those who have nothing to do with you in the same category with peoples that are most of them your own colonists and some conquered rebels? Athenians, as far as right goes, they think one has as much of it as the other, and that if any maintain their independence, it is because they are strong, and that if we do not molest them, it is because we are afraid, so that besides extending our empire, we should gain in security by your subjection. The fact that you are islanders and weaker than others, rendering it all the more important that you should not succeed in baffling the masters of the sea. And of course, the Athenians there are referring to the fact that they have the reputation as the greatest naval power of Greece, and here's this island people, and that if this island people, the Melians, this weak little city-state, are able to prevent themselves from being dominated by Athens, then again, that sets a dangerous precedent from the standpoint of the Athenian Empire, of a little country standing up to them and resisting them. Melians, but do you consider that there is no security in the policy which we indicate? For here again, if you debar us from talking about justice and invite us to obey your interest, we also must explain ours and try to persuade you if the two happen to coincide. How can you avoid making enemies of all existing neutrals, who will worry that one day or another you will attack them? And what is this but to make greater the enemies that you have already, and to force others to become so who would otherwise have never thought of it? So the Melians are trying to play to interest rather than justice and right now. They're saying, okay, well, you only care about what's in your interest. Well, do you really want every currently neutral polity in Greece to be hostile to you instead of neutral? Now, the Athenians reply, why, the fact is that continentals generally give us but little alarm. The liberty which they enjoy will long prevent their taking precautions against us. It is rather islanders like yourselves, outside our empire, and subjects smarting under the yoke, who would be the most likely to take a rash step and lead themselves and us into obvious danger. Melians. Well then, if you risk so much to attain your empire, and your subjects to get rid of it, it were surely great baseness and cowardice in us, who are still free, not to try everything that can be tried before submitting to your yoke. So the Melians are saying, look, we've got as much right to resist your domination as you're claiming to dominate us. Athenians, not if you are well advised, the contest not being an equal one, with honors as the prize and shame as the penalty, but as a question of self-preservation and of not resisting those who are far stronger than you are. Melians. But we know that the fortune of war is sometimes more impartial than the disproportion of numbers might lead one to suppose. To submit is to give ourselves over to despair, while action still preserves for us a hope that we may stand erect. So the Athenians are basically throwing it down, making it clear, look, the stakes for you if you resist us are destruction. While the Melians counter by saying, no, if we submit, we know we've lost our independence, whereas if we go to war, sometimes the smaller does beat the stronger, and maybe, just maybe, we'll win. So the Athenians respond as follows. Hope, danger's comforter, may be indulged in by those who have abundant resources, if not without loss, at all events without ruin. But its nature is to be extravagant, and those who go so far as to put their all upon the venture, see it in its true colors only when they are ruined. Let not this be the case with you, who are weak and hang on a single turn of the scale, nor be like the vulgar who, abandoning such security as human means may still afford, when visible hopes fail them in extremity, turn to invisible, to prophecies and oracles, and other such inventions that delude men with hopes to their destruction. Melians. You may be sure that we are as well aware as you of the difficulty of contending against your power and fortune, unless the terms be equal. But we trust that the gods may grant us fortune as good as yours, since we are just men fighting against unjust, and that what we want in power will be made up by the alliance of the Spartans, who are bound, if only for very shame, to come to the aid of their kindred. Our confidence, therefore, after all, is not so utterly irrational. So the Melians are saying, well, the gods might back us up since we do have justice on our side. And also the Spartans, who we haven't been actively allied with, if they see you Athenians attacking us, might actually come help us. The Athenians respond, when you speak of the favor of the gods, we may as fairly hope for that as yourselves. Neither our pretensions nor our conduct being in any way contrary to what men believe of the gods or practice among themselves. But when we come to your notion about the Spartans, which leads you to believe that shame will make them help you, here we bless your simplicity, but do not envy your folly. The Spartans, when their own interests or their country's laws are in question, are the worthiest men alive. Of their conduct towards others, much might be said, but no clearer idea of it could be given than by shortly saying that of all the men we know, they are the most conspicuous in considering what is agreeable, honorable, and what is expedient, just. Such a way of thinking does not promise much for the safety which you now unreasonably count upon. So the Athenians are saying, look, the Spartans think that what's convenient is what is good too, so don't count on them. Melians respond. But it is for this very reason that we now trust to their respect for expediency to prevent them from betraying the Melians, their colonists, and thereby losing the confidence of their friends in Hellas and helping their enemies. Athenians. Then you do not adopt the view that expediency goes with security, while justice and honor cannot be followed without danger. In danger, the Spartans generally court as little as possible. So here the Athenians are pointing out, and justifiably, that the Spartans are often extremely cautious. Melians respond, but we believe that they would be more likely to face even danger for our sake, and with more confidence than for others, as our nearness to Peloponnese makes it easier for them to act, and our common blood ensures our fidelity. Athenians. Yes, but what an intending ally trusts to is not the goodwill of those who ask his aid, but a decided superiority of power for action. and the Spartans look to this even more than others. At least, such is their distrust of their home resources that it is only with numerous allies that they attack a neighbor. Now is it likely that while we are masters of the sea, they will cross over to an island? Good question. Athens was by far the superior naval power over Sparta. So the Athenians are pointing out, look, you're an island. Even if the Spartans do want to come help you, how are they going to do it? Melians. But they would have others to send. The Cretan Sea is a wide one, and it is more difficult for those who command it to intercept others than for those who wish to elude them to do so safely. And should the Lacedaemonians or Spartans miscarry in this, they would fall upon your land and upon those left of your allies. And instead of places which are not yours, you will have to fight for your own country and your own confederacy. Athenians. Some diversion of the kind you speak of, you may one day experience, only to learn, as others have done, that the Athenians never once yet withdrew from a siege, for fear of any. But we are struck by the fact that, after saying you would consult for the safety of your country, in all this discussion you have mentioned nothing which men might trust in and think to be saved by. Your strongest arguments depend upon hope in the future, and your actual resources are too scanty as compared with those arrayed against you for you to come out victorious. This, if you are well advised, you will guard against, and you will not think it dishonorable to submit to the greatest city in Hellas when it makes you the moderate offer of becoming its tributary ally without ceasing to enjoy the country that belongs to you. Nor when you have the choice given you between war and security will you be so blinded as to choose the worse. And it is certain that those who do not yield to their equals, who keep terms with their superiors, and are moderate towards their inferiors, on the whole succeed best. Think over the matter, therefore, after our withdrawal, and reflect once and again that it is for your country that you are consulting, that you have not more than one, and that upon this one deliberation depends its prosperity or ruin. So that's the end of the dialogue, and Thucydides continues in his narration. The Athenians now withdrew from the conference, and the Melians, left to themselves, came to a decision corresponding with what they had maintained in the discussion, and answered, quote, "Our resolution, Athenians, is the same as it was at first. We will not, in a moment, deprive of freedom a city that has been inhabited these 700 years, but we put our trust in the fortune by which the gods have preserved it until now, and in the help of men, that is, of the Spartans. And so we will try and save ourselves. Meanwhile, we invite you to allow us to be friends to you and foes to neither party, and to retire from our country after making such a treaty as shall seem fit to us both." Such was the answer of the Melians. The Athenians, now departing from the conference, said, "Well, you alone, as it seems to us, judging from these resolutions, regard what is future as more certain than what is before your eyes, and what is out of sight in your eagerness as already coming to pass. And as you have staked most on and trusted most in the Spartans, your fortune, and your hopes, so will you be most completely deceived." Thucydides continues. The Athenian envoys now returned to the army, and the Melians, showing no sign of yielding, the generals at once betook themselves to hostilities. Subsequently, the Athenians removed most of their army, leaving behind them a certain number of their own citizens and of the allies to keep guard by land and sea. The force thus left stayed on and besieged Melos. The Melians attacked by night and took the part of the Athenian lines over against the market, and killed some of the men, and brought in corn and all else they could find useful to them, and so returned and kept quiet while the Athenians took measures to keep better guard in future. Summer was now over. The next winter, the Spartans intended to invade Athenian territory, but arriving at the frontier found the sacrifices for crossing unfavorable and went back again. About the same time, the Melians again took another part of the Athenian lines, which were but feebly garrisoned. Reinforcements afterwards arriving from Athens in consequence, the siege was now pressed vigorously, and some treachery taking place inside, the Melians surrendered at discretion to the Athenians, who put to death all the grown men whom they took, and sold the women and children for slaves, and subsequently sent out 500 colonists and inhabited the place themselves. End quote. So there you go. The Melians appeal to what is just, what is right. The Melians just want to be left alone. The Melians just want to stay neutral. But Team Athens decides, no, they've got to join our empire. They've got to join our alliance or die. And despite some minor successes during the siege, the Athenians ultimately are able to crush the Melians with superior numbers. And that's it. men of the city are killed, women and children enslaved, and the Athenians colonize the island of Milos. The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. So in summary, I think that there's a lot of lessons here as far as what war does, hypocrisy, the bizarre mental disease that in modern times we would refer to as nationalism, or jingoism even, the fact that even a place that starts off paying lip service to what might be considered humane values very quickly in the difficulties of war, abandon those. In Pericles' funeral address, we've got probably a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of whitewashing of what Athens is really all about and how it really acquired its power and its empire. But then we see the brutality in the Melian dialogue of what happens when even those pretenses are set aside. Let me just mention a few things that come to my mind from American history. One would be that at the start of the Second World War, when the United States was not directly involved, when Britain and Germany first started bombing each other, including bombing of residential areas and so on, President Franklin Roosevelt completely condemned such actions as, you know, uncivilized, eight ways from Sunday, and you know, basically tried to condemn the two sides for doing that to each other. Fast forward a little over 2 years later, after the United States was officially in World War II, and not only did the United States start deliberately bombing civilian areas, but as the war proceeded, the United States did far more bombing of civilian areas, inflicting far more casualties on civilians from the air than any other participant in World War II by a pretty good margin. Another example would be, after World War II, the United States played the key role in crafting the Nuremberg Code of Ethics when it comes to science and medical experiments, and yet, as I've covered in my America Does Mengele series a while back, within just a few years, the United States government was routinely flouting the Nuremberg Code and all the other rules and regulations derived from it on experiments that included CIA mind control experiments and government experiments involving putting nuclear material into unwitting test subjects. And then the last example I'll mention that comes to mind of how war, and including sort of Cold War, has and low-key and what some people call small wars have this decivilizing corrosive effect that causes you to even set aside pretending to adhere to your supposedly cherished ideals is the American attitude towards torture and the U.S. government's actions in regards to torture, including the recent torture material that just got out about it, the degree to which the U.S. government has been routinely torturing people in the so-called war on terror. And it's not that the U.S. government and those acting in the name of it had not tortured people in the past. You can find plenty of examples of torture during the Filipino War that I covered a long time ago in this podcast. You can find examples of it in the Vietnam War, etc. But at least back then, the government still felt like it had to pay lip service to "we don't torture, torture is bad," and to portray those examples that did come to light of torture as being, you know, bad apples, so to speak, and as being the exception and not the norm. And even as recently as a few decades ago, the United States was very outspoken in condemning torture. And I think it was under Reagan that we signed on to important anti-torture treaties and so on. And now, well, now we don't even, I fall into the same trap as everybody of using "we" to describe the government, which I shouldn't, but the United States government no longer even makes the pretense, no longer even pays lip service to the idea that torture is awful and should never be conducted under any circumstances, just like the Athenians setting aside even the pretense of justice and fairness. And saying, basically, might makes right, might is right. Whatever we think furthers our interests is what we consider to be good. Those are just some parallels in recent American history that come to mind to some of the developments that we see in the Peloponnesian War in these passages that I've shared with you. So I hope you found this interesting. I hope you found some useful information, some things you can draw lessons from in these sections from Thucydides' Peloponnesian War. I appreciate your time and attention. If you have any comments about this particular show, please feel free to leave them in the comments section for this episode. And you can also email me with any sort of questions or comments, feedback on the show, whatever. The email address is profcj@profcj.org. That's profcj@profcj.org. You can connect with the show on Facebook and on Twitter as well. And the Dangerous History Podcast is now available on iTunes. And just recently, I got on Stitcher. So we're on Stitcher as well. So whatever is your favorite method of podcast delivery, you can now get the Dangerous History Podcast through the method of your choice. Remember, there are several ways you can support the show. One is simply to spread the word about it in any way you can to people you think might enjoy it. Also consider leaving a review or a rating in places like iTunes and Stitcher in order to encourage others to give the show a try. And you can also help out the show financially. Any help you can spare is much appreciated. One is you can donate directly through PayPal. You can go to profcj.org/donate to send a few bucks my way to help out here. And another thing you can do to help out the show financially is to purchase items from Amazon.com by first going through the affiliate links found on profcj.org. And if you do that and then buy some stuff on Amazon, I'll get a small percentage of it at no additional cost to you. And I usually have links that are particular books and sometimes movies related to what I'm talking about in an episode. But keep in mind that you can help me out with some affiliate change, even if you don't buy those specific items, just by going into Amazon through the links on my site. Even if you end up buying, you know, a new spatula or something, rather than the history book you had clicked on my site, doesn't matter. I'll still get a little affiliate cut there. So anyway, anything you can do to help me out is much appreciated. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.